This podcast is sponsored by Talkspace.
Last year, I went through many different life changes. I needed to take a pause and examine how I was feeling in the inside to better show up for the ones who need me to be my best version of myself.
When you're navigating life's changes, Talkspace can help. Talkspace is the number one rated online therapy, bringing you professional support from licensed therapists and psychiatry providers that you can access anytime, anywhere.
Living a busy life, navigating a long-distance relationship, becoming a first-step father, Talkspace made all of those journeys possible. I could speak with my therapist in the office. I could speak with my therapist in the comfort of my home. I was never alone.
Talkspace works with most major insurers, and most insured members have a $0 copay. No insurance, no problem. Now get $80 off your first month with promo code SPACE80 when you go to Talkspace.com. Match with a licensed therapist today at Talkspace.com. Save $80 with code SPACE80 at Talkspace.com.
Welcome back to The Deep Dive. Today, we are taking on a truly colossal figure, a man who really shaped the modern Middle East as we know it.
We're talking about Abdulaziz bin Abdul Rahman Al Saud. But everyone just knows him as Ibn Saud.
And his story is just incredible. This isn't a man who inherited a kingdom. He didn't inherit an oil fortune.
No, not at all. He literally built a kingdom from scratch, then discovered the oil. He goes from being this exiled tribal chief, basically living in poverty, to a monarch on the global stage.
So for you, the listener, our mission in this deep dive is to really get into the mechanics of that. How does that happen?
Exactly. How does one man, starting with almost nothing, I mean, just his family name and a handful of loyal followers, manage to take over almost all of Central and Northern Arabia in, what, 30 years?
It seems impossible.
It does. And we need to look at the unique blend he used. It's this combination of, you know, traditional Bedouin warfare, this incredible religious zealotry he harnesses, and then this unbelievably pragmatic, almost cynical diplomacy he uses with the great powers.
That pragmatic streak is so important because the whole thing is built on sheer audacity. When you dig into the sources, you find these stories that sound almost like myths, but they're real.
They are.
We're going to cover the famous 40-man raid that took back his ancestral home, Riyadh.
A legendary moment.
Mm-hmm.
And we have to talk about the Ikhwan, this group of religious purists he creates. He empowers.
And then has to crush when they get in his way.
Viciously.
Yeah.
And finally, those two huge meetings in 1945, one with Roosevelt on a warship, the other with Churchill. Those meetings basically set the course for global energy politics for the next, well, 80 years.
It's just a phenomenal story. One man's sheer will meeting these massive historical forces, like the fall of the Ottoman Empire and the West's thirst for oil.
And the result is a dynasty where, right up to today in 2025, every single king has been one of his sons.
Incredible. So let's start at the beginning. Not in a palace, but in exile. Okay, so let's set the stage for this this improbable start. Abdulaziz ibn Saud, he's born on January 15th, 1876, in Riyadh.
Right. And he's the fourth child, the third son of Abdul Rahman bin Fazl.
And his father is a key figure here. He was the last ruler of what historians call the second Saudi state, the Emirate of Najd.
And that family history isn't just, you know, a bit of background color. It's everything. It's his entire motivation. The Al Saud family had already been a major power in Central Arabia for 130 years.
All tied up with the religious reform movement, Wahhabism.
Absolutely. That ideology had already fueled their first attempt to control the peninsula, the first Saudi state, which was, you know, eventually destroyed by the Ottomans back in 1818. So when Ibn Saud is born, his family is really just hanging on.
Living on borrowed time.
Completely. They're holding on to the scraps of a once great, religiously driven empire.
And their main rivals, the ones right on their doorstep, were the Al-Rashid family.
Always the Al-Rashid. Constantly fighting for control of that central plateau, the Najd. And the defining moment of Ibn Saud's childhood is when the Al-Rashid finally win.
This is in 1891. He's just 15 years old.
15. And his family loses Riyadh. They're forced into exile. And this isn't just a political defeat. It's catastrophic. They lose their home, their history, their religious heartland.
That period of exile must have been just formative, doesn't even begin to cover it.
It shaped everything about him. And it wasn't like they were just waiting things out in a comfortable palace somewhere. Their journey shows you how completely their power had collapsed.
Where did they go first?
First, they had to seek refuge with the Al-Murra, a Bedouin tribe out in the southern desert. They were completely dependent on their hospitality.
Just think about that. the son of a ruling house suddenly having to rely on the kindness of nomadic tribesmen. The psychological impact.
It must have been immense. And it was a desperate scramble. They were with the Almora for a bit. Then they moved through Qatar for a couple of months, a brief stop in Bahrain.
Before finally ending up in Kuwait.
Yes, and this is a crucial detail. They were allowed to settle in Kuwait by the Ottoman authorities. They spent nearly a decade there.
So they're essentially political refugees.
On an Ottoman leash. The Ottomans were perfectly happy to let the al-Rashid control Najd. But Kuwait is where Ibn Saud really starts his political education. He's not just waiting. He's watching. He's learning. He's building a network.
And the key figure for him there is the ruler of Kuwait, Mubarak al-Sabah.
Exactly. And what's so fascinating is the tension this creates inside his own family. Ibn Saud starts spending time in Mubarak's majlis, his court, learning the ropes of geopolitics.
But his father didn't approve.
Not at all. His father, Abdul Rahman, was deeply conservative. He saw Mubarak's lifestyle as too worldly, too modern, not in line with the strict Wahhabi ideals the al-Saud were meant to represent.
But Ibn Saud saw the bigger picture.
He had that foresight. He saw past the religious dogma and recognized that Mubarak al-Saud was a real political player with regional power. Building a relationship with him was far more valuable than sticking to his father's strict social code.
That ability to put politics before piety, even in small ways.
It would define his entire career. And that education in Kuwait is what leads directly to the moment that launches him. The legendary raid on Riyadh.
1902. This wasn't some grand invasion. It was a gamble. A desperate, long-shot gamble.
Utter desperation, but executed with pure genius. It starts small, in November 1901. Ibn Saud and a small group of relatives, his half-brother Muhammad and his cousin, the incredibly important Abdullah bin Jilui, they set out on a raiding trip into Najd.
So the initial goal isn't even to take Riyadh.
No, it's just to survive, to harass the tribes allied with the Rashidis. But the further they go, the more pressure he's under to stop. The Rashidi leader is panicking, asking the Ottomans in Baghdad for help, asking Qatar for help.
To stop these little raids.
Exactly. And the pressure works. A lot of his men desert. Even his own father sends a message telling him to call it off, that trying to take Riyadh is suicide.
But he refuses.
He refuses. He knows that his entire claim to legitimacy rests on one thing, taking back the capital. Not on pity raids. He had to recapture the spiritual and political home of his family.
Which brings us to the night of January 15th, 1902. The tactic he uses is just... it's like something out of a movie.
It really is. He leads just 40 men. 40! Against a walled, fortified city. And how do they get in? No siege engines.
They use tilted palm trees as ladders to scale the walls.
It's incredible. A quiet infiltration followed by a moment of spectacular, very public violence.
The Rashidi governor, a man named Ajlan, is killed.
Killed by Ibn Saud's cousin, Abdullah bin Jilui, right out in the open in front of his own fortress. The message couldn't have been clearer. The al-Saud are back.
Okay, but we have to ask. The 40-man story, how much of that is hard fact and how much is, you know, political myth-making?
Oh, it's absolutely both. The core event is true. A small, outnumbered force took a fortified city by surprise. But the number 40, it has this huge symbolic weight in Islamic history.
Right, it's a number associated with quests, with spiritual trials.
Precisely. And the way the official chronicles focus so heavily on that single moment, the death of the governor, it shows you they immediately understood its power as propaganda. It wasn't just a military win. It was framed as a divine validation of the al-Saud's right to rule.
And the political investment he made back in Kuwait pays off immediately.
Instantly. Mubarak al-Sabah, the ruler his father disapproved of, sends 70 more warriors under the command of Ibn Saud's younger brother, Saad.
That reinforcement must have been critical.
It was everything. It let him actually hold the city, and he immediately moved back into his grandfather's residence. He was sending a message at every turn. This isn't a new state. This is a restoration.
It's the definitive start of what becomes the third Saudi state.
All from that one perfectly executed raid, an amazing start.
So 1902, he's got Riyadh back, but he's still just a small-time player in a very dangerous neighborhood. The next 30 years are this masterclass in consolidation.
It is. He needs a plan, and it's a three-pronged strategy. Military force, religious ideology, and very, very clever diplomacy.
Let's start with the military side. How does he build his army?
Well, the Riyadh raid itself was his best recruiting poster. His charisma, plus the victory, brought all these old supporters of his family out of the woodwork.
People who'd been laying low under the Rashidis.
Exactly. And he was smart. He made sure his fighters were paid, that they were well-armed, and it worked. Within just 2 years, he'd taken back nearly half of the Nedj from the Rashidis.
But that kind of expansion gets you noticed.
It does, and in 1904, he gets a serious reality check. The Ottomans and the Rashidis join forces and hand him a major defeat. It was a clear warning shot.
A message that the great powers would step in if he got too ambitious.
Right. And that defeat was a crucial learning moment for him. Instead of giving up, he just changed tactics. He couldn't win a straight fight, so he switched to guerrilla warfare.
Hitting supply lines, harassing their movements.
Systematically disrupting them. And it was so effective that the Ottomans eventually had to retreat. They just couldn't sustain their presence.
And then the Ottomans, unable to beat him, try to, what, co-opt him?
A classic imperial move. In 1905, they officially named him the Kwamakwam, or governor, of southern Nedjd. They're trying to absorb him into their system.
Giving him a title, recognizing his power, but keeping him under their nominal control.
And he accepts it. He holds that title for years, all while continuing to fight the Rashidis. It's just pure pragmatism. That all ends in 1906 when the Rashidi leader is killed in battle, which basically ends the Ottoman presence for good.
But the real game changer, the most innovative tool he creates, is the Ikhwan. We can't talk about the founding of Saudi Arabia without understanding the Ikhwan.
It is absolutely essential. The Ikhwan, the Brotherhood, started around 1912. And you're right, it's not just an army. It was a revolutionary social engineering project.
So what was it exactly?
It had two interconnected goals, approved by the local Salafi religious scholars. First, and most obviously, it was an incredibly motivated fighting force. These guys were fueled by a belief that they were waging a holy war, a jihad, to purify Arabia.
And the second goal was just as important.
Even more so, arguably. It was an agrarian policy. The idea was to settle the nomadic Bedouin tribes. These tribes were the traditional source of all the instability and chaos in the region.
So he gets them to stop wandering and settle down in these fixed agricultural colonies.
Called Hijra. And this is the genius of it. The system completely broke down the old tribal loyalties. Your allegiance wasn't to your local sheikh anymore. It was to the Ikhwan Brotherhood, and by extension, directly to Ibn Saud as their supreme leader, their imam.
He weaponized religious fervor to solve his manpower problem and his internal security problem at the same time.
Perfectly put. He turned the chaotic energy of the desert into a disciplined, fanatical, and loyal army. And then, right as this machine is getting up to speed, World War I breaks out.
A whole new game. Suddenly he's caught between the dying Ottoman Empire and the rising British Empire.
And his early moves are so careful. He actually makes a secret deal with the Ottomans in 1914 to become a wali, a high-ranking governor. But the war makes that deal worthless.
And the British get very interested very quickly.
They can't have him aligned with the Ottomans. So they move fast. And that leads to the Treaty of Darin in December 1915. This is a landmark moment.
Because it's the first time a major global power officially recognizes his state.
It is. The treaty makes his lands a British protectorate. And the British give him money, a lot of money, £5,000 a month plus supplies.
And in return?
In return, he has to promise to fight the Rashidis, who are allied with the Ottomans. And crucially, he has to let the British start defining his borders.
But you mentioned something interesting earlier. He got British weapons, but he didn't always use them right away.
No, he stockpiled them. It was a huge strategic risk. He was taking British money and protection, but he was hoarding the weapons for his own future plans. He knew the British were allies of convenience.
He was playing the long game.
Always.
Yeah.
He wasn't going to be a British pawn. He was positioning himself to be the main player after the war was over.
At the same time, though, the British are also backing another major player in Arabia.
Yes, they were hedging their bets. They were famously supporting Hussein bin Ali, the Sharif of Mecca in the Hejaz region.
T.E. Lawrence, Lawrence of Arabia.
That whole story. And this set up an inevitable collision course. The Hashemite family, led by Sharif Hussein, control the ultimate prize, the holy cities of Mecca and Medina.
Which to the Ikhwan was unacceptable.
Completely. They saw the Hashemites as religiously corrupt. So conflict between them starts brewing as early as 1917, even while both sides are technically allied with the British against the Ottomans.
So after World War I ends, Ibn Saud has this stockpile of British weapons and a fanatical army.
And he unleashes them. He launches a final campaign against the Rashidis in 1920, and by 1922, they're completely and utterly destroyed.
That victory doubles his territory.
At least. It gives him this huge amount of leverage for the next crucial step.
The 1922 Ikuwer Conference. This sounds like a dry diplomatic meeting, but it's where the modern map of Arabia really gets drawn.
It is. He sits down with Sir Percy Cox, the British High Commissioner for Iraq, and they are literally drawing lines on a map.
defining the borders for Iraq, Kuwait, and what would become Saudi Arabia.
And it's classic diplomatic horse trade. Cox gets Ibn Saud to recognize the new British protectorates and their borders. This was vital for Britain.
Why so vital?
They needed stability along the Persian Gulf coast. These were crucial coaling stations for their ships going to India through the Suez Canal. They couldn't have Ikhwan raids disrupting that.
So Ibn Saud has to give up some land claims on the borders.
He does. He agrees to the famous neutral zones between Saudi Arabia, Iraq, and Kuwait. But in exchange, he gets the ultimate prize, British recognition of his sovereignty over the vast...
This podcast is sponsored by Talkspace.
Last year, I went through many different life changes. I needed to take a pause and examine how I was feeling in the inside to better show up for the ones who need me to be my best version of myself.
When you're navigating life's changes, Talkspace can help. Talkspace is the number one rated online therapy, bringing you professional support from licensed therapists and psychiatry providers that you can access anytime, anywhere.
Living a busy life, navigating a long-distance relationship, becoming a first-step father, Talkspace made all of those journeys possible. I could speak with my therapist in the office. I could speak with my therapist in the comfort of my home. I was never alone.
Talkspace works with most major insurers, and most insured members have a $0 copay. No insurance, no problem. Now get $80 off your first month with promo code SPACE80 when you go to Talkspace.com. Match with a licensed therapist today at Talkspace.com. Save $80 with code SPACE80 at Talkspace.com.
Control heartland he now controlled.
As soon as those northern and eastern borders are set, he turns his attention west.
To the Hejaz, to holy cities, and the conquest is swift. By 1925, his Ikhwan forces capture Mecca from Sharif Hussein.
Ending 700 years of Hashemite rule.
A monumental shift in power. He is then proclaimed king at Hejaz in 1926. A year later, he makes Najd the kingdom as well. He now rules this dual kingdom.
And the British make it official with the Treaty of Jeddah in 1927. He's now a fully independent monarch.
He is. But now he faces the ultimate political irony. The very force he used to build his kingdom, the Ikhwan,
is about to turn on him. They see him as a sellout.
Because for them, the holy war never ends. They wanted to keep raiding into Transjordan and Iraq, which were now British protectorates. They didn't believe in borders drawn by infidels.
And provoking the British is the one thing Ibn Saud cannot afford to do.
His whole state is built on that pragmatic relationship. He forbids the raids, and the Ikhwan see it as a profound religious betrayal. The tension just explodes.
He tries to reconcile with them, doesn't he?
He does. He calls a big meeting in Riyadh in 1928, but the main Ikhwan leaders refuse to show up. And that refusal is basically a declaration of rebellion.
Which leads to a civil war.
A short but brutal one. He crushes the Ikhwan rebellion at the Battle of Sabilla in 1929. And this victory is more than just military.
It's a political statement.
A definitive one. It establishes that while the state is founded on Wahhabi ideology, the ultimate political authority, the person who decides on war and peace, is the king, not the religious fanatics.
And with that internal challenge crushed, he can finally complete his project.
On September 23, 1932, he formally unites his two kingdoms, Najd and Hejaz, into the single kingdom of Saudi Arabia. And it's his kingdom. He sidelined his own brothers to centralize power completely in himself, from a 40-man raid to a unified nation in 30 years. It's staggering.
So the kingdom is created, but now he has to run it. And the story of his rule is really the story of one thing, oil.
Everything changes with oil. The economic transformation starts almost right after unification.
In 1933, he grants the oil concession, not to the British, interestingly.
No, and that was a very deliberate choice. He granted it to an American company, Chevron's subsidiary. But it's important to remember, for the first 5 years, they found almost nothing.
So the kingdom was still broke.
Absolutely. Still relying on money from the Hajj pilgrimage and that British tribute. The big world-changing discovery doesn't actually happen until 1938.
And once the oil starts flowing, especially after World War II, that brings in massive American influence.
By design. This was a core strategic decision by Ibn Saud, guided by his advisors like St. John Philby. He actively preferred the Americans to the old European colonial powers.
Why the U.S.?
Simple. No colonial baggage. The British and French had been carving up the Middle East for decades. The U.S. was a powerful partner who could provide security, but they were distant. They weren't looking to run his country.
And you see that preference in his financial dealings, too.
Clearly. When the kingdom needed huge loans for development, he went straight to the U.S. Export-Import Bank. He deliberately avoided the World Bank or European banks. It was a political signal.
Our future is with America.
Precisely.
Okay, so amidst all this very rational, strategic, economic policy, there's this one wonderful, eccentric project, the Royal Railway.
Ah, yes. What his advisors called the old man's folly.
He was just insistent on it, wasn't he? Despite everyone telling him it was a terrible idea?
Completely insistent. He wanted a railway from the Persian Gulf all the way to Riyadh and eventually onto Jeddah.
And he got it. Aramco built it for him.
They did. It was finished in 1951. It cost $70 million, all paid for from his personal oil royalties.
So why did he want it so badly if it made no economic sense?
It was about prestige and centralization. A railway was a symbol of a modern state, and it physically connected his remote capital, Riyadh, to the world. And to be fair, it did help Riyadh grow.
But his advisors were ultimately right.
They were. As soon as a paved road was built next to it in 1962, the railway lost all its traffic. It shows that collision between a traditional ruler's vision and the sheer pace of modernization.
Shifting to foreign policy, the new kingdom quickly flexes its military muscles.
It does. The Saudi-Yemeni War in 1934 is a really pivotal moment.
First modern war between Arab states.
Exactly. And the Saudis win. Decisively.
Yeah.
They used modern British armored cars and French tanks. It sent a message to the whole region that the old days of tribal raiding were over. Saudi Arabia was a modern military power.
Then World War II breaks out. He declares neutrality.
Formal neutrality, yes, but he was generally pro-ally. But there's a great story that shows his independent streak.
The German ambassador, Fritz Graba.
Right. In 1938, after an attack linked to Graba happened on a British pipeline in Iraq, Ibn Saud gave him refuge in Saudi Arabia. It was a calculated move, a little jab at the British, showing them he wouldn't be pushed around.
Who's keeping his options open?
Always. But the most important diplomatic events of his entire reign happened right at the end of the war, in 1945.
The two big meetings, first with FDR.
On the USS Quincy in the Suez Canal, they spent 3 days together. And this meeting is the bedrock of the entire modern U.S.-Saudi relationship.
It's the oil for security deal.
That's the tacit agreement. The U.S. gets access to the oil, and in return, America essentially guarantees the security of the al-Saud regime. It's a partnership based on pure strategic interest.
And then shortly after, he meets Churchill.
In Egypt. And the contrast is just stark. According to the Saudi reports, it was unproductive.
Why? What was the difference?
Roosevelt talked about the future, about commerce, about security. Churchill hammered him on the issue of Palestine and Jewish settlement. Ibn Saud was completely opposed to Zionism and just wouldn't budge. He resisted Churchill's pressure in a way he hadn't with Roosevelt.
And finally, on the conflict front, Saudi Arabia does participate in the 1948 Arab-Israeli War.
They do, but it's really a token contribution. They send maybe 1,000 troops attached to the Egyptian army. Their real focus was on internal security and protecting the oil fields, not on a major foreign war.
So let's go back inside the kingdom. With the oil money flowing, how does he actually govern this huge new country and enforce that strict Wahhabi ideology?
The oil wealth was the ultimate tool for centralization. He could use money stipends, jobs, projects to force the nomadic tribes to settle down.
Which was a massive social change.
It was everything. It finally ended the centuries-old cycle of petty wars and tribal feuds. He shifted allegiance away from the tribe and towards the central state, which was now the source of all prosperity.
And that came with a requirement for religious conformity.
A strict one.
Yeah.
And this is where the ideology becomes very visible and very controversial. Wahhabism is obsessed with the idea of Tawhid, the absolute oneness of God. Any veneration of saints, tombs, or holy sites is seen as a form of polytheism or shirk.
Which led to the destruction of historical sites.
Famously, yes. The demolition of shrines like the Al-Baqi Cemetery in Medina, where many of the Prophet's family were buried. It was a huge political statement disguised as religious purification.
And it caused diplomatic problems, didn't it?
Big ones. In 1926, his ikhwan beat up a group of Egyptian pilgrims for playing bugles, which they considered an un-Islamic innovation. Ibn Saud had to issue a formal apology to the Egyptian government. It happened several times.
One last difficult topic from his reign, slavery.
It's a critical point. He didn't abolish it. In 1936, he regulated it, restricting imports, setting rules for treatment. But the practice itself continued throughout his life.
It was his son, Faisal, who finally abolished it.
Yes, not until 1967. It's a stark reminder of how slowly some social changes came, despite the massive economic transformation.
On a more personal level, though, how did he see his role as king, especially with all this new wealth?
He was known for his charity. He had a very simple philosophy. Two things are essential: religion and the rites inherited from our fathers. He saw the oil wealth as a gift from God that belonged to all his people.
And he put that into practice.
He did. He would literally have money handed out to the poor. He set up guest houses to distribute food. It was a core part of the social contract. You are loyal to the king, and the king provides for you.
And one surprising detail from the sources is his view on women's education.
It is surprising. For such a conservative society, he was apparently quite encouraging. He's quoted as saying, very simply, "It is permissible for women to read." It's a small thing, but it shows a pragmatic mind, willing to push the boundaries a little for the good of his people.
The ultimate legacy of Ibn Saud isn't just a country, it's a dynasty. His family is the state.
They're one and the same. The numbers are just staggering. He had almost 100 children, including 45 sons, and the entire political structure of modern Saudi Arabia is based on that fact.
The succession moves from brother to brother among his sons.
Exactly. And that's why even today, every king has been a direct son of the founder.
And he built this dynasty through strategic marriage. He had 22 wives.
Right. But most of those weren't love matches. They were political alliances. He married the daughters of tribal leaders to cement loyalty, to end feuds. It was a very sophisticated way of knitting the country together at the family level.
But the women who were actually his closest political advisors were his own blood relatives.
Two women in particular, his aunt, Jawhara bint Faisal, was incredibly influential, especially in the early days. She's the one who really drilled into him the sense of family destiny, who pushed him to retake Riyadh. She was a trusted advisor until she died.
And his sister, Nora.
He was so close to his sister, Nora, that he often introduced himself with the phrase, "I am the brother of Nora." In that culture, that is a profound statement of respect and affection. She was his moral anchor.
Let's turn to his more complex political views. His relationship with the British, for example.
It was a very pragmatic but wary relationship. He took their money and their protection, but he always had a clear line. He famously said, "The English are my friends, but I will walk with them only so far as my religion and honor will allow."
He was making it clear he was not their puppet.
Never. He was always asserting his own sovereignty.
And his views on Zionism and the Jewish people are, well, they're very fraught.
It's essential to separate the two things. He was a diehard opponent of the political project of Zionism, and his rhetoric about Jews could be extremely harsh, drawing on negative religious texts. He called them a race accursed by God.
But at the same time, he made a distinction.
A very important one. He considered non-Zionist Jews to be good friends of the Arabs. And more than that, he condemned indiscriminate violence. He was furious about the 1929 Hebron massacre of Jews, calling it a violation of Islamic principles.
So his hostility was political and territorial, not necessarily racial in the modern sense.
It was focused very specifically on the Zionist project in Palestine. It's a complex and contradictory position, but the distinction is there in the sources.
Which brings us to the end of his life and the decision that would shape the kingdom's future succession.
His final years were tough. He had heart disease, severe arthritis, he was half blind. He survived multiple assassination attempts. Ruling this new kingdom was a dangerous business.
His succession plan was already complicated because his eldest son, Turki, had died.
Right. So the line fell to his second son, Prince Saud, who was named Crown Prince back in 1933. But everyone knew, including the king himself, that Saud was not the most capable choice.
He favored his other son, Faisal.
Overwhelmingly. Faisal was the brilliant one, the diplomat, the experienced statesman. The king famously said, "I only wish I had three Faisals."
So why didn't he just name Faisal as his heir?
Because he was terrified of starting a civil war. He thought that bypassing the established heir, Saud, would rip the family apart and destroy the new kingdom before it even got on its feet.
So he chose stability over competence.
Immediate stability, yes.
Yeah.
He knew Saud and Faisal were already bitter rivals. He basically kicked the can down the road, hoping the institution was strong enough to survive the conflict he knew was coming.
A tragic final choice, in a way. He dies in his sleep on November 9, 1953.
With Faisal at his side, his last words to his sons were a plea, "You are brothers, unite." He was buried simply in an unmarked grave next to his sister, Nora.
So, to sum up this incredible life, a man starts as a refugee, leads a tiny raid, unifies dozens of tribes, defeats all his rivals.
And then presides over one of the most sudden and massive economic transformations in human history. He built a nation on two pillars that seem completely opposite: the most austere religious revivalism and the most incredible gushing resource wealth.
He managed the great powers perfectly. He took what he needed from Britain, then pivoted to the United States without ever letting them take over.
A true master of statecraft. He accomplished his life's goal. As he said, in my youth, I made a nation. Now in my declining years, I make men for it.
But there's that final paradox, the one that still defines Saudi Arabia today. The man whose rallying cry was unite left behind a system succession passing between his 45 sons that almost guaranteed future conflict.
He saw it coming. He said near the end of his life that he feared his two greatest enemies would be his children and my possessions, meaning his sons and his oil wealth. And he was right. By choosing Saud over Faisal, he prioritized short-term unity, but baked in a perpetual power struggle for the next generation.
So what's the final thought for you, the listener, trying to understand the kingdom he built?
The final provocative thought is this. Ibn Saud's last great decision, to favor tradition over competence, combined with that sudden tsunami of oil money, created the fundamental tension that still exists in Saudi Arabia. It's the constant grinding conflict between a system of rule based on family, a brotherhood of aging princes, and the modern technocratic demands of managing unimaginable wealth. That tension, that internal struggle, is the DNA he encoded into his kingdom at the very moment of its creation.
Corporate megastores are spending millions lobbying DC politicians on one-sided policies that send small businesses tumbling. They want to enact harmful credit card mandates that take resources away from your local credit union and community bank, leaving Main Street businesses with less access to credit, making it harder for your family to pay for everyday goods like gas and groceries. Tell Congress to guard your card and oppose the Durbin-Marshall credit card mandates.
Paid for by Electronic Payments Coalition.